Chapter 2. Revolutions in Understanding Mind and Brain. The greater the doubt, the greater the awakening. The smaller the doubt, the smaller the awakening. No doubt, no awakening. C.C. Chang, from The Practice of Zen. You live through that little piece of time that is yours, but that piece of time is not only your own life. It is the summing up of all the other lives that are simultaneously with yours. What you are is an expression of history. Robert Penn Warren from World Enough and Time. In the late 1960s, during a year off between my first and second years of medical school, I became an accidental witness to a profound transition in the medical approach to mental suffering. I had landed a plum job as an attendant on a research ward at the Massachusetts Mental Health Center, where I was in charge of organizing recreational activities for the patients. The MMHC had long been considered one of the finest psychiatric hospitals in the country, a jewel in the crown of the Harvard Medical School teaching empire. The goal of the research on my ward was to determine whether psychotherapy or meditation was the best way to treat young people who had suffered a first mental breakdown diagnosed as schizophrenia. The talking cure, an offshoot of Freudian psychoanalysis, was still the primary treatment for mental illness at MMHC. However, in the early 1950s, a group of French scientists had discovered a new compound, chlorpromazine, sold under the brand name Thorazine, that could tranquilize patients and make them less agitated and delusional. That inspired hope that drugs could be developed to treat serious mental problems such as depression, panic, anxiety, and mania, as well as to manage some of the most disturbing symptoms of schizophrenia. As an attendant, I had nothing to do with the research aspect of the ward and was never told what treatment any of the patients was receiving. They were all close to my age. College students from Harvard, MIT, and Boston University. Some had tried to kill themselves. Others cut themselves with knives or razor blades. Several had attacked their roommates or had otherwise terrified their parents or friends with their unpredictable, irrational behavior. My job was to keep them involved in normal activities for college students, such as eating at the local pizza parlor, camping in a nearby state forest, attending a Red Sox game, and sailing on the Charles River. Totally new to the field, I sat in rapt attention during ward meetings, trying to decipher the patient's complicated speech and logic. I also had to learn to deal with their irrational outbursts and terrified withdrawal. One morning I found a patient standing like a statue in her bedroom with one arm raised in a defensive gesture, her face frozen in fear. She remained there, immobile, for at least 12 hours. The doctors gave me the name for her condition, catatonia, but even the textbooks I consulted didn't tell me what could be done about it. We just let it run its course.